This is the All Sports Podcast devoted to your favorite teams in North Texas.
Welcome to Ballsy, a production of the Dallas Morning News and Sports Day.
Our weekly show is proudly hosted. Okay, strike that. Our show is hosted by Kevin Sherrington, Evan Grant, and myself. I'm David Moore, and who knows, maybe we'll have a special guest or two along the way.
Catch other episodes by subscribing to the Ballsy Podcast on iTunes.
We're also on social media. Just search Ballsy Podcast on Facebook and Twitter, and you'll be notified of the latest episode. Don't forget, it's Ballsy with a Z.
Are you ready, sports fans? Ballsy starts now.
Hello, everybody. Welcome into Ballsy, the Sports Day DFW Dallas Morning News Sports Podcast. I am Kevin Sherrington, joined by Evan Grant. Hello, Evan.
Good morning, Kevin.
That sounded kind of weird, but okay. Evan, it's the morning after the day we never thought would come. Texas has a second national championship in men's basketball. This is a pivotal day in both my lifetime and career. Waiting all this time, I was 10 years old when Texas Western won the national championship. I was 9, actually, almost 10. Won the national championship over Kentucky, Adolph Rupp's Kentucky, and an historic team, the first black, all-black starting five for Texas Western and Don Haskins. And now, after all this time, after 73 years after Baylor first played in a national championship game, also against Kentucky, they came out last night and completely dominated, befuddled, bamboozled Gonzaga, an undefeated team trying to become the first team since Indiana in 1976 to go all the way through the season without losing a game. And frankly, they were never even in that game last night on Monday. That was an unbelievable performance by the Bears. I think Houston should feel much better about what happened in the semifinals when the Bears blew them out. They did just about as well as Gonzaga did in the championship game Monday, 86-70, the final score. We have a second men's national champion in Texas. Unbelievable.
I don't want to take anything away from Baylor at all, which is always what you say when you're about to take something away.
Well, this is a bad way to start. Holy cow.
I mean, you know, that semifinal game, I'd love to go back and see the track record for how teams have played in these like classic semifinal games, these absolute wars of semifinal games, and how they recover two nights later and play the national championship.
Well, it's funny you should mention that, because in 1983, Houston played Louisville in the semifinals. The second half of that game, I called it at the time a dunk back by Houston. They came back in that game. Many people believe or observers believe that game changed the course of college basketball because the tempo changed. It was high flying dunks everywhere. It was an unbelievable performance. And a lot of people feel like that because of that game that Houston was, listen, there's no way North Carolina State can beat Houston, right? Look what they just did to Louisville, a really powerful team, an emotional, momentous game. And then come back 2 days later, they're flat. They came out very very poor, and were just not ready for the kind of game that Jim Valvano had designed for North Carolina State.
Yeah, again, this is not to take anything away from the accomplishment of Baylor. I mean, obviously, Drew has done a great job there. He has built a national championship program. They deserve all the credit in the world. But I also know, based just on what my Twitter timeline looked like on Friday night and again on Saturday, that Gonzaga-UCLA game, I think for Gonzaga, that was in a lot of ways the national championship game. Hadn't they tried to play UCLA twice during this misfit of a season and had both of those games kind of washed out by COVID situations? And so to win that game in overtime, I think it was going to take a little bit of out of them. But I think for Baylor to come out and just absolutely dominate from start to finish, you can't, when you have that position, you have to take advantage of it and you have to continue to step on the gas. And that's what the Bears did last night.
Yes, they did. And, you know, one of the things that they established here, and of course,
I should say Monday night, because we're not recording this on Tuesday at all. I don't want anybody to think.
No. Monday night. Yeah. Okay. This is a timeless podcast. Also a clueless one, but that's beside the point. The thing that that Baylor did last night, I think, is that what they established is that, you know, we already knew that guards ruled the NCAA tournament, and Baylor had four guards who were as good as anybody else in the tournament, probably. But the real issue for me in this game, and what really clearly rattled Gonzaga, was Baylor's defense. This is a lot of the same kind of formula that Chris Beard had for Texas Tech in 2019 when the Raiders made Red Raiders made the final against Virginia before losing. And now certainly it was the formula for this Baylor team. So it'll be very interesting to me to see the pattern that emerges here. Cause I have to believe that there's going to be a lot of schools across the country that are going to decide, you know what, it is really hard to find guys who are great shooters and play great offense, but we can find guys who can play defense, who will be gritty, scrappy kind of players. And I really think that Texas Tech and Baylor have really set a new standard here. And I'll be interested to see what Chris Beard will be able to do as he takes over at Texas, if he can institute that same brand of defense and offense, very hard-nosed play that he had at Texas Tech and had such success with. And if Mark Adams, who is the new coach at Texas Tech, he's the old coach also. He was Chris Beard's assistant, longtime assistant. He's 64 years old, been around a long time. A little bit of a surprising hire to me. I thought there were a lot of guys that they could have hired. I know that they interviewed Darvin Ham, former player at Texas Tech, who's an NBA assistant. They also were supposedly going to look at Joe Golding and Abilene Christian, who, of course, upset Texas and sent Shaka Smart on his way to Marquette, and as well as Grant McCaslin at North Texas, who also has some Texas Tech ties. So there were a lot of good candidates for that job. We'll see if Mark Adams was the right guy or not. A lot of the Tech players have already talked about the fact that they are going to stay. They're not going to enter the transfer portal with the 4 million other players who are now out there in the transfer portal. And by the way, I'd just like to say along those lines, the transfer portal is not the evil that everybody's making it out to be. Okay. Most of the players who are in the transfer portal are just guys who played at small schools, who wanted a chance to play someplace else, who weren't playing at other places, and now they are. So I think what we have to realize here is this is a good thing for these college basketball players, in my estimation.
Well, and it's clearly ramped up the mid majors, right? You know, I mean, it's made the mid majors a much bigger player come tournament time, because a lot of these kids are transferring from powerhouse schools where they were recruits and didn't play to more mid major type schools and getting a lot of chance to play, and we're seeing a lot more impact come tournament time.
Well, you know, it's like that thing that the Rangers always talk about, that, you know, it's more egalitarian.
Kevin, why are you always bringing this back to baseball?
I know. Well, you know, especially this baseball, which is not very good, but it's a more egalitarian type of thing. Listen, when you've got Gonzaga and Baylor in the NCAA final, you know, what in the world's going on in college basketball? Well, this is a great thing. This is a sign that, you know, for everybody who's all worried about the one and dones and how they dominated basketball, well, this is a sign that here's a new wave running through college basketball. And this is a good thing. I think this is going to be great. I think you're going to see more teams with success with older players. You know, that's what Chris Beard wants. He wants older players, and we'll see if he's able to do that at Texas. It's going to be a little different for him there. I have questions about whether that fan base will be happy with the kind of players that he's always come up with. If they win, they ought to be happy. That should be the bottom line, right? But you never can tell.
My experience in 25 years is that the Texas fan base has been happy one time, and that was 2005 after it won a national championship. So on the football side. So I don't know that I've ever seen the Texas fan base happy with a coach or a program in my quarter century here.
Not for very long, they're not.
No. I also think the one other observation I would make here on this is I'm stunned that you're making the statement that the Big 12 is leading the way in defense in a sport.
Yeah, that sounds crazy, doesn't it? Watching the football. Well, you know, though, that's what the Big 12 was better in football and defense last year. But we're not talking about football. We can't win anything in football.
It's not a football state.
It's a basketball state. Come on. You know, speaking of which, we're going to bring on our old pal right now, Calvin Watkins, who's going to come in and talk to us about the draft. But I want to say this first for Calvin Watkins, who is the father of basketball players. Is that not true, Calvin?
Yes, I am the father of basketball players. They used to be football players. In fact, my son went to U of H football camp. My middle son went to U of H football camp. And who was the coach there at the time? The former UT quarterback.
Major Applewhite.
Major Applewhite was there.
And he made a real impression on you, didn't he, Calvin?
Made a big impression. He wanted to know who my son's high school coach was. Chris Selflo was offensive line coach. I knew him from Tulane. So I was thinking, hey, we're going to U of H. You know, we're good. But then my kids decided to play basketball. And then I think our boy got fired or something. So,
well, but they could still go to Houston and play for Kelvin Sampson. I've seen your son dunking on Facebook. Is that Miles dunking on Facebook?
Yeah, Miles is dunking, yeah. If I thought he could play for Kelvin Sampson, I would not be doing this call. I'd be looking for agents, okay? We would not be having this call.
Where does Miles get those kind of hops? Because there's no way you can't jump over a doorstep. I mean, come on.
I think when I was in high school, I was able to grab the rim, but I could never dunk.
If you were falling from the top of the gym, you could grab the rim.
Falling from the top of the gym, save myself. I could grab the rim. Yes. You know me so well.
That's good to know.
I think it skips generations. So I assume maybe my father or maybe my grandfather was athletic. I don't know. Or maybe it comes from the mom's side of the family.
That's when both my boys play sports in college, and that's what we all say in our family. Where did this come from? Calvin, it's great to have you on. We just been talking about Baylor winning the national championship. Baylor's now won in men's basketball and women's basketball. It's the center of the basketball universe in Waco, Texas. Who could have imagined that? Certainly not me. Listen, I watched a lot of bad Baylor basketball over the years, covered some really bad games in Heart of Texas Coliseum down there. Got locked out. I had to climb over a barbed wire fence after leaving Heart of Texas Coliseum. Not that I'm holding any grudges or anything against Baylor because of that, but I am really happy for Baylor to have achieved this. It was hard fought. Scott Drew has done a fabulous job there, and hats off to those Bears. Enjoy this national championship. Ride that wave as long as you can. Let's talk about the Cowboys and the draft. We've had a little bit of a shifting again. We had another trade. We already had one trade where San Francisco traded up for the third pick. Now we have another trade, not a trade of a first round pick, but a very a big trade for Carolina. Sent three picks to the Jets for Sam Darnold. And so that would seem to indicate not that that Carolina with the eighth pick was going to take a quarterback necessarily, but they might have. And it seems to be that probably with the eighth pick, now Carolina probably takes an offensive lineman. Maybe Rashawn Slater, who is very popular these days for his utility and his ability to play probably anywhere across the line of scrimmage or across the offensive line anyway. I don't think he's going to play on the other side. So I wanted to ask you, first of all, Calvin, how any of this impacts the Cowboys, do you think? Do you think that if Patrick Surtain is still available at 10, the Cowboys will take him?
Yeah, I think if he's available at 10, he's going to Dallas. I think what you're seeing is teams that need quarterbacks are trying to find him. Like I saw just before we started, I saw Atlanta is now thinking about trading out of the number 4 pick. And they don't need a quarterback. They have Matt Ryan. So say you're Denver, say you're New England who needs a quarterback, they might be trying to get there to 4. So we might have 4 quarterbacks taken in the first 4 picks. And then the 5th team is Cincinnati, who don't need a quarterback. They got your boy Joe Burrow. So now that's where the draft starts. And so, yeah, we'll see the cornerbacks fall in a sense to 10. And that's where Patrick Surtain or J.C. Horn will be for Dallas. But I think Surtain is there for Dallas.
You know, it's very interesting, and I'm glad you brought that up about Atlanta at 4. And, of course, Evan might argue with you about whether Matt Ryan was still the quarterback.
I was about to interrupt on that and say, you sure about that? I think the people in Atlanta are quite confused about what exactly the Falcons are doing with Matt Ryan at this point.
Well, it's interesting you say that, because if they restructured his contract, right? So if they cut him next year, there's like $40 million in dead money that they're going to have to absorb. So you have to go, well, that's telling you that he's going to be here a while. You know, and now that I saw Adam Schefter tweeted this morning that Atlanta's thinking about trading out. So that's, to me, they're not getting a quarterback, because they're 4 quarterbacks that you could all get right there. And if Atlanta's want one, they're getting out of there to try to get maybe Kyle Pitts or maybe a tackle or a defensive player.
Yeah, I was just looking at the board. To me, the guy mm-hmm. that stands out is Kyle Pitts to me for the Falcons. I mean, there's not many game-changing tight ends or receivers of that caliber. And I think that he's going to be an impact pick, maybe the biggest impact player outside of the quarterbacks on the board.
Well, if Atlanta trades out of 4, if they trade down very far, they're not going to get Kyle Pitts, because he's going to be mm-hmm. a top 5, 6, 7 pick. So that will be very interesting to see how that works. But I got to tell you, I think, and I wrote a column about this last week, I really believe that there's no way that Bill Belichick sits there at 15 with all those quarterbacks sitting up there, with all the problems he's having at quarterback now, and doesn't try to go after one of those guys. And I believe that Mac Jones just looks like a Tom Brady starter kit. And I don't know how he doesn't try to do that. But now I see Daniel Jeremiah, who I like, and I like his judgment of quarterbacks anyway, a former NFL quarterback. He's got San Francisco taking Mac Jones at 3, which is really vaulting him to the top of the draft. He went from a guy who was maybe a first-round pick to a guy now who could be a top 5 pick, if we're to believe that kind of projection. So would the Cowboys at this point – let me ask you this, Calvin. Would the Cowboys at 10 – let's say that one of those 5 quarterbacks has fallen. You know, Trevor Lawrence is going number 1. Zach Wilson's going number 2. Those are pretty much givens now, I think. The questions will be Mac Jones, Trey Lance, and Justin Fields, and where they go. If one of those 5 is still – one of those 3 is still available at 10, would the Cowboys – consider trading down 2, 3, 4, 5 spots if they thought they could still get one of those defensive players that they really wanted?
That's interesting. It's a gamble. So, like, say Denver. Say we get there, and not Denver, New England, which is 15.
Right.
And Dallas is at 10. So, say Belichick calls Steven and says, let's make this swap. Dallas has to decide, will Surtain or Horn be there at 15? You know, and they have to look at who's in between 10 and 15 if they think their guy's going to be there. And if not, then they have to say, okay, let's get Horn from South Carolina, who was fantastic this past year. And if he's not there, do you gamble? And you know, the Cowboys love to gamble. Do they get Caleb Farley from Virginia Tech, who's coming off back surgery? You know, whose stock has fallen. He's probably a late first round pick now because of the back. So do you say, well, we can get him. We can get him right, like we did Jalen Smith, like we did Sean Lee, and we'll pick him at 15. So that's the gamble you take. But to answer your question, I say if I'm Dallas, I stay at 10, get my guy. If we need a quarterback, that's your problem because we got our quarterback. So you get your guy and you move on.
So let me ask you that about your guy. Do you believe that Surtain is clearly better than J.C. Horn and Caleb Farley if Caleb Farley is healthy?
I don't know. Patrick Surtain's dad is pretty adamant that he thinks his son is the best corner in the draft.
But I think my son should be playing in Major League Baseball. But, you know, that doesn't count, Calvin.
I mean,
you've watched the Rangers, Kevin.
Well, that's true. They can play that kind of Major League Baseball.
They both of those guys played in the SEC, so they saw top talent every Saturday.
Right.
You know, Horn was fantastic at his pro day. Surtain comes out there and he looks fantastic too. I don't think you can go wrong with either guy. It is interesting that as of last week, the Cowboys had yet to meet Patrick Surtain, you know, with a virtual. Now they meet everybody at some point, and I think they will meet with him. But it was interesting that here we are. It was like late March, and they had not met with him. But that might not be a big deal. That might be a smokescreen. But I do believe from everything I've read, because I haven't been any pro days with my stopwatch, but I think Surtain is probably the best corner in the draft. And if he's there, you got to take Patrick Surtain.
Let me ask you this question, Calvin. Based on what you're hearing from the Cowboys, is Patrick Surtain the guy that they want? Is he their target at 10?
No one has said that's our guy. Because I think no one has ever told me in my years of covering the team that we're targeting this guy. Because they're always afraid that we could target this guy and he's not going to be there.
Right.
So what they do is they'll say, there's three or four guys that we like. He is the guy they like. Horn is the guy they like. They did like Farley, but now the back raises some concerns about whether or not he's worth getting at 10 was in the scenario that Kevin presented. If you trade down to say 15 New England, do you get him there? You know, or if you go even further down to say 24 or whatever, is that, will we accept getting that guy at 24? And if Kevin's writing that night, maybe we'll find out if Kevin believes that's okay. So, but definitely I think Surtain is the guy that they're interested in. Why wouldn't they? They went to his pro day. They went to Horn's pro day. So they have a good feel for what he's about. Joe Witt, who's their secondary coach, who coached in Atlanta, as you know, he saw a lot of SEC football. So there's a lot of tape on this kid. But I think Patrick Surtain is the guy that they're targeting.
Now, let me ask you something else here about this. I'll throw another little monkey wrench into this thing. A lot of mock drafts really want the Cowboys to take an offensive lineman, whether that's Rashawn Slater, who's a more versatile guy, or Penei Sewell, who sat out this last season from Oregon, but from all accounts that I've read about him, considered a generational offensive tackle. Mm-hmm. So if one of those two guys is still available at 10, would the Cowboys seriously consider one of them instead of a cornerback?
Bucky Brooks, who works for NFL.com, is a former scout and player. He is one of the first people I saw that mentioned this, saying, get your tackle, and then in the second round, get your corner, like you did the previous year. Because his thought process and a lot of other people's thought processes are the tackles are they're falling apart. So at some point, you got to replace them. Let's replace them now. Or have one of those young rookies be the swing tackle, and then they take over for Tyron or for Lyle Collins in 2022. And I get it. I understand that. If you do draft Slater at 10, I think the other kid will be off the board. I think he's going to Cincinnati because they got to protect Burrow.
Yeah, I agree with that. They got to protect Burrow. Yeah. They have to take Sewell.
Yeah. Sewell, I think, is gone. So it's Slater, basically. Then you better get in the second round at 44, you better get your corner. Either it's Greg Newsome or Caleb Farley. And if you get Farley, then guys like you, Kevin, are going to write, this better work out because Farley's coming off of back surgery and he's supposed to be ready in late July. So we better see his behind in the Hall of Fame game against the Steelers.
If they get him in the second round, I got no complaints with the Cowboys.
You got no complaints? Okay. No. Okay. I'll take that back.
Because this is supposed to be a pretty minor, you know, surgery that he's having on. It's not like it's reconstructive surgery on his back. He doesn't have spinal stenosis, you know, as far as we know. So
it's a disectomy. It's what Romo had. It's similar to what Tony had. But Tony was 50 years old when he got his, and this guy's in his 20s.
I think he was like 49, actually.
He's 49.
It was before his birthday. It was his 50 season. Yeah.
That's year 50.
Yeah.
I would say no on the tackle. I would get my corner because I'm sure the next year there's going to be generational tackles that come around, you know? So, and from what I was told, Tyron Smith's neck surgery is not a major surgery. You know, he didn't get neck fusion. Lyle Collins had a hip problem and that's supposedly it leaves some pain. So they should be fine. But yes, at some point you do have to address these issues. Zach Martin's 30 years old. He's one of the best guards. You got to address. At some point, you got to replace him. So when do you replace him? And I don't think the line is it's time to replace the line. Get your corner, take care of your defense, and then you can get your tackle in the middle rounds, or you can get a generational tackle next year.
Yeah, I have to tell you, I would agree with that because I think what people look at is the fact when you're – and, of course, it works both ways. When you're right on top of a situation, sometimes you don't really see it, you know.
Right.
But for the most part, I believe in the local people. I believe in the local media that they know the situation better than even Bucky Brooks knows it. And mm-hmm. and I think that it's interesting to me, the whole Lyle Collins thing. So let me ask you about that. There seemed to be an impression left, or at least there was an impression left with me, that there was something a little fishy with Lyle Collins last year. Like he was not taking things seriously, not doing what he's supposed to do. Had really made such a great impression on the Cowboys, and it had kind of obviously come out of nowhere after not getting drafted, and was one of the Cowboys' best personnel moves of the last 10 years was with Lyle Collins. Is his head right? Is everything okay with him? Is he ready to play? And was it more of a physical thing last year or a mental thing?
I think it was more of a physical thing because I heard that he was out of shape.
Yeah.
And so I inquired. And
as you will.
And someone said, no, he's in shape. He just has a bad hip. And if your hip is sore, it's hard to get around. And if you're, 6'4", 300 pounds, it's hard to move around with a bad hip. I don't care who you are. So that was his problem, mainly. The attitude apparently is fine. I will say this. He did practice for about a week. And you know the great blue-white game that the Cowboys always have, that this year they made the media shoot the helmets instead of the formations this year because Mike McCarthy wanted to be like Chuck Knoll. Well, sorry, I didn't mean to go off on a tangent. Anyway, in the blue-white scrimmage that used to be open to the media that now is restricted now because Mike McCarthy's got, you know, all these great game plans.
You're not bitter about this, are you?
No. Yeah, I'm very bitter about this. Yeah. Lyle Collins participated in the blue-white scrimmage. And then the next day, he was done. So I think he was on his way back. He was just dealing with this hip problem for about a year and a half. And finally, they just said, let's get the surgery. While Tyron Smith was dealing with this neck problem for about 2 years, from what I was told. And then finally, he said, look, I can't do it again another year. So let's get the surgery. So it appears that these guys are on the path to recovery and they should be back to their, you know, pre-injury form. That's what we hope. Oh, that's what the Cowboys hope.
Yeah. All right. I don't want to go down this rabbit hole too far with the draft. Cause you know, when people do these 7-round drafts and it's like, you get to the 4th and 5th and 6th and 7th round, it's like, you gotta be kidding me. Right. You know,
I barely know after the first round, I don't even know.
Yeah, absolutely. But let me ask you this. So we're just talking about offensive tackles and offensive linemen. Let's say the Cowboys take Patrick Surtain or JC Horn with that first, that 10th pick or wherever they end up picking. I think that would be excellent. That's exactly what they need to do. You're answering a need and you're getting probably one of those two guys is the best defensive player in the draft. So I think that's an excellent pick at that point. In round two, I have been in favor of what I think our John Owning, our film studies major, has proposed, which is that if they could get Richie Grant, the safety from UCF, second round, be a really nice pick. He's a real ball hawk, a guy who just seems to have a skill set that really fits in the NFL. I think that would be great, even though they have all these safeties. They just, what did they just sign? Like six safeties, it seemed like, after all these
safety playing linebacker.
Safety playing linebacker, whatever that means. Holy cow. Keanu O'Neal is like, what the heck, what is he, you know, he's gonna be lining up at quarterback, wildcat, next thing you know. So anyway, you've got all that situation. What if they went for a Sam Cosmi from Texas, 6'7" offensive tackle, started 3 years at Texas. What about something like that? Is it possible you think that they could go for that offensive tackle if it's somebody of that caliber?
Yeah. I mean, I'm okay with them. When you talk about, let's find our tackles of the future, there you go, second round. I mean, this is a pretty good draft for offensive linemen. You know, you might get 10 linemen taken in the first round. You know, you're going to get one, you're going to get two in the top 10. And then a lot of teams need protection, you know. Even Dak Prescott needs protection. You know, I saw with the Steelers, they got rid of like three offensive linemen. They need guards and tackles. They're going to get somebody at the bottom half of the first round. So, yeah, if I'm Dallas, I don't mind getting him. Alex Leatherwood from Alabama, he's a very good interior offensive lineman. Right. You can get him in the second round. Now, I understand the point John's making about let's get a safety because, yeah, the safety position has been a disaster ever since Darren Woodson left, probably, maybe when Roy Williams left. But, and Grant is considered like maybe the second best safety behind a TCU kid, Trevor Mooring. But you better take care of your line. And here's the future swing tackle. You can get him in the second round, or maybe you get your future center. I know they drafted Tyler Biots from Wisconsin last year, but hey, Mike McCarthy always likes to say, we want competition. So, okay, here's some competition here. So, yeah, I'm all for getting offensive linemen around too, no doubt.
No doubt. Well, listen, Calvin, it has been great having you on. We've loved, you know, you're so much better at this than David Moore. It's unbelievable. I hope that David's not listening to this.
No, he's skiing right now in Utah somewhere.
He's skiing in Utah. What is he? We can't have him up there doing that kind of thing. Come on.
That's what he does. That's what David, that's what football writers do. They go skiing in Utah.
Then he's going to go sit around and drink some wine and comment on that and the quality of it, the bouquet and all the rest of that stuff.
The jammy oakiness.
Yeah. Cheryl, I'm enjoying the oakiness of this. It's got a little bitterness to the bottom of it.
Hints of jackfruit and notes of tobacco and instant
hints
coffee.
And notes. Yeah. Hints and notes. I love that kind of talk, you know.
Wine talk.
Yeah. I get a real note of oakiness in my Diet Coke. But anyway.
I am an expert on the balance of carbonation to syrup in the Diet Coke.
Oh, and, listen, nobody's better than me.
The amount of ice that you want to have in the Diet Coke. And I can do a whole blog on that if people would like.
No, we don't. We know you would like that. Mr. Rodeo Goat Sandwich and,
the Evan Grant Burger. Get the Evan Grant Burger, Rodeo Goat. It is kicking some ass this month. It is a bacon and Gouda stuffed patty with some bull's blood microgreens, which I have no idea what the hell they are, a French fry potato salad, which who knows, and it's got some hurtado or Zavala brisket on top of it. So go get that, Kevin. And you too,
if it's an Evan Grant sandwich, if it's an Evan Grant sandwich, it's not bull's blood. It's bull something, but it is not bull's blood.
You know, it's an Evan Grant sandwich, it's very salty.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. Calvin, it's been great having you on, man. We appreciate it. We'd love to have you back sometime when you can work your way into our schedule.
Hey, no problem. Whatever you need, just shoot me a text at night. I'll answer it. I'll be ready.
It was not like midnight. It was.
No, I'm always up late. I'm always up 2 o'clock in the morning. I got nothing.
That's right. That's you. That's your
day or night, there. Anytime.
Anytime.
Thanks, Calvin. We'll see you.
Never know when the Cowboys are going to have their next crisis in the middle of the night. So
got to be ready.
Right. All
right. Thanks, guys.
See ya. There goes Calvin Watkins. He's the greatest. We love him. So we've talked about the national championship for Baylor today, and what that means for Texas basketball and portends for programs in this state. You can't knock Texas basketball anymore, pal. We're back, baby. It's a whole new day here.
I think you can knock Texas basketball. You can't knock basketball in the state of Texas.
In the state of Lone Star basketball. I'll call it that. Yeah, there you go. I'm predicting in the next 10 years, three more national championships from the state of Texas. How about that?
You want to attach schools to those?
No. Okay. But, I mean, look, we had two teams from Texas in the Final Four this year.
Yeah.
Texas Tech played in the championship game 2 years ago. That's three schools right there, pal, right on the doorstep.
That's right.
And before Baylor kicked the door down, kicked it down. Unbelievable. What a program. That's Scott Drew. You know, I have to say, I was not really on board with Scott Drew early on. He's a peculiar character, but he really knows what he's doing. He's proven
okay.
Himself. Point took 18 years.
Okay, Billy Bear.
Billy Bear, that's me. Billy Bear, that's me. Yeah, I don't know if that really works, but anyway. So we've talked about the draft. We've talked about Baylor and basketball in Texas, the newly crowned king of men's basketball. They were already close to being the queen of women's basketball. They got it going on down there in Waco. And now we're going to talk about a real bummer. We're going to talk about the Rangers. Man, what a letdown. We go from the pinnacle of sports to the basement. Just like that.
Yeah, I was thinking about this coming home last night from the ballpark. They've played four games. Nobody expected this team to be very good. And they haven't been. They've lived up to all the expectations. I actually was thinking, you know, has my tone been too hard on this team because nobody expected them to be any good? But I think there have been some things that have just shown up that have been worrisome in these first four games. And by and large, you know, save for the top of the first inning in Kansas City, they've been fairly non-competitive in three of those four games. So it's been a little bit disheartening to see this start.
I think, you know, the thing about this to me that's not very surprising is that I just going into the season figured this is not going to be very good rotation. This is not going to be very good pitching. There, of course, we already knew that the bullpen was bullet riddled, and that was going to be an issue for a while, maybe for a good while. But you know, when Kyle Gibson is your opening day starter, this is a serious issue. This is a team that went from the last couple of years of having Lance Lynn and Mike Minor at the top of its rotation. This was a rotation as good as a lot of teams and a lot of competitive teams in baseball.
Well, it was good. It was good at the top of the rotation. It had bona fide top half of the rotation pitchers. They have none this year. And I mean, the fact that Kyle Gibson was the opening day pitcher said really all you needed to say about this rotation. But all of that said, you expected Kyle Gibson to come out and throw strikes and not nibble on opening day, especially with a 5-0 lead. That he piddled that away very, very quickly was disappointing. And it put pressure on a very young and inexperienced bullpen, which was a worst case scenario for this team in at the start of the season. Kohei Arihara was about as expected in his second start. Jordan Lyles was quite good on Sunday. Better than I expected. And then yesterday, you know, Mike Fultonevich, or Monday, I should say, back on Monday, much earlier in the week, Mike Fultonevich, 35 pitch first inning with, I think it was 7 of the first 10 hitters he faced. He had full counts or 6 of the first 9. Just can't do that. That's unsustainable. And once again, it just put the Rangers in a really bad position. And what I feel like is possible of happening here is, as good as the Rangers' offensive approach has been for the start of the season, you keep getting into situations where your starting pitcher is going 30 and 30 plus pitches in the first inning, where you're falling behind early in games, or where you're blowing leads. Your offense is going to get out of that patient, disciplined approach and try and make something happen. And then that's when you really get into some dangerous characteristics.
You know, I didn't go out to the game yesterday because I hadn't had my second shot yet. I get my second shot Wednesday. So then I'll be able to go out there and you know, I didn't want to get out there and contribute to any more of the chaos of how many people were there? 6 million people, 7 million, something like that.
It was a sellout in a 40,000 seat stadium of 238,000 fans. But I should say that's just me being cynical. Look, there are, for opening day, you've got family tickets, which are comps. Comps are not included in sold tickets. You've also got a lot of sponsorship obligations, and really the Rangers probably had 2 years worth of sponsorship obligations. So that accounts for the other 2,000 or so seats. I will say this, though, with all of that and accounting for all 40,000 seats in the stadium, there still were only about 37,500 in the building. There were some chunks of empty seats.
Let me ask you something. I didn't notice this before. Has Dallas Truck World always been stamping all over the field?
No, that's new. I can't recall if there was a Camping World ad on the field last season or if it was during the World Series, but they did not have ads on the grass at Globe Life Park.
They had it on the mound. Dallas Truck World on the mound.
There were early in the season last year, most teams had something on the back of the mound that was equality or
right.
Some teams had Black Lives Matter. There were statements on the back of the mound, but as the season wore on, I believe they did go to, there were some ads there. And look, Major League Baseball basically told teams last year, sell whatever you can. You need to make whatever revenue you can. You know, all those tarps in the outfield that covered the outfield seats, they sold all those. So right now, based on the amount of money that baseball did not make last year, I think MLB has told teams, Be as creative as you can. If you can sell something, go ahead and sell it.
I don't think you have to really tell the Rangers owners to try to make money. You know, they don't need any encouragement.
No, I think sometimes they may need to be held back a little bit, but no.
Yeah, exactly. So anyway, I know that just, and I don't want to labor on this Foltynewicz start, but I know there was some frustration with the strike zone, you know, where is it, you know, and it did seem to be a little all over the place, and Toronto was fouling off a lot of pitches. But what does that tell you when a team is fouling off? That's what hitters are supposed to do. You know, that's telling me I'm not able to put this guy away. And that was a struggle for Foltynewicz.
I'm not going to sit here and criticize the strike zone yesterday. Again, when, you know, when Steven Matz comes out and absolutely dominates the Rangers for seven innings, it's hard for me to say that an umpire, I don't believe that umpires have vindictiveness against any one team. They may have bad strike zones, but I don't think they've got a one-way bad strike zone. So either the Rangers were far too indiscriminate at the plate yesterday, or Steven Matz figured out how to master that strike zone that Jansen, Visconti had behind the plate. What I had a problem with Jansen Visconti behind the plate is how long he delayed his strike calls. That was maddening.
It's a little dramatic. That's like, you're not the show, pal. Let's just move
you're
on.
You're not Leslie Nielsen.
Yeah, let's call the strike and move on. Yeah, and Steven Matz looked like I thought he was going to throw a no-hitter. I thought the first couple innings the Rangers looked completely clueless against him. He was, you know, three-pitch strikeouts. You know, it was just unbelievable at that point.
You know, and I mean, again, after that really patient first weekend with a ton of walks, they face a lefty. They had faced a lefty in minor, but they're going to face a lot of lefties. I mean, they've got a predominantly left-handed lineup, and until they prove that they've got a way to effectively counter lefties, managers are going to set up their rotations to face lefties. And they finish off the series with Toronto against a lefty in Hyun-Jin Ryu, who, you know, was the National League runner-up in 2019 for the Cy Young and is the American League runner-up in 2020. So it ain't going to get easier with the left-handed pitchers.
Speaking of which, thank you for that transition. We're going to talk about the fact that the Rangers need a right-handed hitter to back up Joey Gallo. They've had Nate Lowe there, but he's left-handed, and he's certainly been – Nate Lowe has been the early on anyway, the acquisition of the season for the Rangers. He's lived up to everything they hoped he would be. It's a very small sample size, but it sure looks good. But you can't have these two left-handers batting back-to-back there.
Well, it's not two left-handers, you know, because you've got Dahl hitting second. You've got Gallo hitting third. You've got Lowe hitting fifth. And on a lot of days, you've got another left-hander behind Lowe. So you can't have five left-handers in a row. You can't have four left-handers in a row. And right now they're really, really, you can. And if the opponent's starting a right-hander, you could potentially stack the three lefties in a row as they did against Kansas City on Sunday. And a lot of that also depends on what the bullpen makeup is of the opponent that you're facing. But the bottom line on all this is, they need a right-handed hitter in the middle of the lineup. Chris Davis was going to be that guy, or at least was going to get the opportunity to be that guy. He's hurt. So they went to Nick Solak, and Nick did not have a good spring training. I thought there were a lot of swings and misses on fastballs, and that has bled into the season. It's been a really rough start for Nick Solak at the plate as the cleanup hitter. And it's been equally as rough at second base. He's had a hard time completing double plays. He's had a hard time at some of the basic stuff at second base. And, you know, they decided to move on from Rougned Odor. They were going to look at Nick Solak this year. What Nick is going to have to do as a second baseman is OPS at about 800 or close to it to be an everyday second baseman. Because what's clear is the defense is always going to be suspect, maybe average at best. You know, I want to say that this kid is pressing a little bit and that he's trying really hard to make himself an anchor in this lineup right now. I think it will get better, but there are reasons why he was not an everyday player at any one position previously, and that's showing up on the defense at second base. But more concerning to me right now is the number of swings and misses. 9 strikeouts and 14 at bats. That's unsustainable.
Yeah, it is. The problem is, and it's not just Nick, who he just looks like a guy that needs to play about, 500 more games at second base before you could really believe in him as a second baseman. He just looks uncomfortable around the bag. He doesn't have a good arm. He's not able to make that, you know, if he cranks it up, yeah, he can get it over there. But you know how that is on a double play. You can't always do that.
When you put more effort into it on a double play, that's when you're liable to overthrow and the ball is going to tail or sail on it.
Yeah, and that's what it's been doing. And as you said, he's not hitting either. I mean, he looks – when they throw him a fastball in, he looks like he's just hacking. And it is really hard to watch. It's painful to watch. So, you know, one of the things that Chris Woodward has tried to sell here is that, all right, look, we're going to play a different brand of baseball here. I know everybody else is homer happy, and what we're going to do is we're going to be fast, we're going to be athletic, we're going to play great defense, we're not going to give up walks, we're going to take pitches, and we're going to get our pitch, you know, all these really fundamentally sound issues, which would be we're all great, and those are all great sells. But right now, they're not playing good defense. And as you said, except now, and certainly on Monday, they look like they were not being as patient at the plate, not taking pitches. And for me, this is always the issue. The worst thing that could have happened for them was to come out like this, to come out and just get drilled by Kansas City in the first two games, because then on a young team, that puts you on such a bad footing. And then they go, and it's 160 more games of this, you know, and that, which is always the issue. You know, fans always want to say, why don't they get rid of these guys and just play young guys? Like, yeah, because this is what happens. You get young guys out there for a long time, you can ruin them, you know, and that is a very dangerous possibility with this team.
And let's break it down to a smaller set, right? Kansas City was the easy part of their start to the season. The Royals were not a good team last year. We're not supposed to be a good team this year. They were going to come home and face a Toronto team that I think has a pretty good lineup. And then it was 7 games against what amounts to a potential World Series matchup of the Padres and Tampa Bay. And so if you get off to a bad start, you don't hold your own here against Kansas City and then Toronto, you're looking at maybe being 2-13 or something like that coming out of the gate. And then it's when guys are looking around the room and saying, oh my God, how bad could this year be? And that's when you really, really get to a dangerous spot. I think the Rangers have for the most part, been pretty consistent. Yesterday, as Woody said, you know, a left-hander who throws and commands a changeup is really difficult for a left-hander to combat. So let's give Steven Matt some credit yesterday. Let's see what happens today and tomorrow. But I think that this team cannot look ahead and cannot say this is what could be awaiting us. They've just simply got to come out and fight each day, because every day is going to be an uphill battle for this club. It really is.
Well, what I want to see from this team were guys take a step up, you know, and Leody Taveras in particular, an example of a guy who in a small sample size last year did a great job, certainly played great defense, showed a little pop and that he hadn't shown in the minors. And so this was all really good. And then the Rangers, in my estimation, went too far. Spring training came out with the idea that he's going to be the leadoff hitter, which I don't know if he'd ever shown that was possibly in his skill set, is to be a leadoff hitter. That they abandoned that, and that was good that they did it in spring training. But still, you started him off with a negative to start the season, you know, to start his spring training. And he's just never recovered. He just looks clueless at the plate.
Yeah, and I don't know how much of that is due to the leadoff thing, because they pretty much 86 the leadoff thing a week into spring training. I was a little bit curious about, you know, the idea that they were going to camp and saying, okay, he's going to be our center fielder and potentially our leadoff guy. But I do think that they said, you know what, we're putting too much on him pretty quickly, and they took that off of him. Where I think the bigger issue is here is, Leody Taveras is the 13th youngest player on a major league roster right now. He's incredibly young. At no level of his minor league career has he shown an ability to be an offensive threat. At best, as a young guy, he's kind of held his own at most levels. The one exception was when he went back to down east for a second year, you know, kind of lit it up for about 2 months and then went straight to Frisco. And this is the problem I have in the Rangers development situation, is the minute a guy seems to show any kind of progress, they're ready to challenge him at the next level. And you're not getting guys up here who you're 100% sure are going to come to the big leagues and not only hold their own, but be successful. You're getting guys that you hope can make the jump. I think there's been a little bit of desperation, a little bit of belief in that, and not enough analysis. And this is, I think, what we're seeing with Leody Taveras. Look, the other day in Kansas City, he had a good 8-pitch walk. Now, he got himself behind in the count early, and he did battle back. But the three balls he took that ended up being the last three balls in the walk were well above the strike zone. I mean, nobody should be swinging at those. He took a walk, and it was key to that, to a three-run inning against the Royals that really kind of sealed the game. My point here is that's one at bat. Can't focus on one at bat, because he can't have one good at bat in four games. That's not progress. That's not acceptable. What you have to see is you have to see good at bats every time out. I don't have a problem with the Rangers having some exposure to Leody Taveras in the big leagues in this April because of the unique circumstances. There is no minor league season right now. If you send him to minor league spring training, it would basically be a repeat of spring training, which gets tedious and will wear a guy down. If you send him to the alternate site, he'd only get about 6 real games. So you get some chance to expose him. And if he doesn't turn it around, if he doesn't show really, really well here very quickly, when the minor league season starts, you send him out, and it has to be with the instructions that, look, you're going to get these things right. We believe in you, but we're not bringing you back until you show that you can dominate. You've got to be an offensive force. He can't just be a good defender. There's no place for that in the game now. He's got to be an offensive weapon.
All right, we're going to wrap this thing up here. But before we do that, I want to ask you one quick thing here, because and this is one of those things that Debbie always does when we're leaving somebody's house. She says, okay, we're going to go. Hey, listen, do you have that recipe for, milk duds? You know, it's like, come on. Now, that's not a question you ask. That's not something you do on your way out the door.
Debbie's making homemade milk duds?
I don't, that was all I could come up with off the top of my head.
Can I get me some of them?
I think I can make milk duds, actually. I think I know how to do that. But anyway, look, Joey Gallo's off to a great start. And he's doing everything they can want him to do, even with such little protection behind him, except when he's had Nate Lowe hitting behind him. That's the big deal too with Nick Solak. He can't be hitting fourth. He can't be hitting fifth. He needs to be hitting eighth or ninth is where he needs to be hitting the lineup right now. But here's my question. Do you think there's any possible way that the Rangers would go to Joey at this point and Scott Boras and say, hey, how about an extension here?
Listen, from my perspective, I look around at the Rangers right now, and this team expects to compete in 23 or 24. And I'm saying, where are the foundational pieces?
Right.
And Joey's the one guy who I think has demonstrated foundational capabilities. I think Isaiah Kiner-Falefa has a real role on this team. I don't know if he's ever going to be the offensive force that you consider a franchise type cornerstone. If it's me, I'm going to Joey Gallo before the trade deadline this year, and I'm identifying that he has those abilities, that as a 27-year-old, he has arrived, and I'm trying to come up with an idea of a creative long-term extension, maybe full of opt-outs after 3 years or something like that, that would give him another real shot at free agency. But I don't, if I hope to lure Trevor Story here next year, if I hope to lure, say, a Noah Syndergaard or a Clayton Kershaw here next year, I better have some hope that there's going to be a team behind him. And right now, I don't see the franchise kind of players to put behind him. So, yes, for me, I think it's something they better think long and hard about, how they can potentially put the best possible contract offer on the table, regardless of what Scott's approach may be and regardless of what Scott may tell Joey. I think they need to at least make an effort here, because I fear that there are not franchise caliber players to restock this team with at this point.
I know people are afraid of making a mistake. You know, they made a mistake with Rougui Odor and his contract. They made a mistake in some ways on Elvis. Not as big a mistake. I can remember when people thought that Michael Young's contract was a mistake. You know, here's my point. You're going to have one of the lowest payrolls in baseball. You can afford to make a mistake on Joey Gallo. Even if first of all, he's going to play a terrific right field. He's going to be a gold glove. I mean, there were 17 defensive runs saved last year in right field last year. I think that was,
he's a great defensive right fielder.
That's twice as much as anybody else in the American League.
And he's matured. I'm completely confident that he's really matured, both as a player, as his approach at the plate, and as a person. And I'm not saying that, look, you go base a contract on four games. I think you've got some time here, but I think before the trade deadline, you better have made an effort to say, what would it take to keep him? Because I also am convinced that the trade deadline has not been a seller's market the last couple of years. I think that trend is going to continue. I think it's going to be maybe even more pronounced this year, with the idea that 2022 may include a work stoppage. So you've got two pretty important decisions to make on that. And for me right now, where my head's at, I feel like it makes more sense to potentially pursue a contract extension before I'm willing to try and trade him.
Yeah, I agree with that. Well, we're going to talk about that some more later as we go along here. We're going to talk more about the MLB draft as that gets closer. And the
Vanderbilt, I watched Jack Leiter on Friday night. I had a big rocking night in Kansas City.
Did you really?
Yeah, I sat in my hotel room eating takeout.
Did you have takeout barbecue?
Not Friday. Friday afternoon, I went and I actually sat in a restaurant for the first time in a year. Had some really good barbecue. And I will say again,
Where did you have it?
At Char Bar.
Char Bar?
Char Bar. which I had not been to before, but I had gotten a tip on Char Bar. It turns out that all the sauces at Char Bar are under the label of Meet Mitch, and Meet Mitch is Mitch Benjamin, who is a co-investor in the restaurant. And Mitch is also the uncle of Rangers pitcher Wes Benjamin. Oh, so I wanted to go try it, and the sauces are really good. The burnt ends were outstanding, and the ribs were out of this world. I will say this again, and this is nothing personal against Kansas City, and I don't know if it was Larry McMurtry or Kinky Friedman or who said it, but the only people in America who get brisket right are the Jews in Texas. And, you know, the brisket in Kansas City, it comes out very thinly sliced. It's not as fatty as we're used to and as we like in Texas. And
you got
to
order it wet.
It's just different, man. And so I will happily go back to Char Bar, and I will get more ribs, and I will get more burnt ends, and I think I will try their sausage. But I think brisket, like Tex-Mex, is not going to be ordered north of the Red River anymore.
There you go. That's a good plan. I like it. All right. That's going to do it for us here on this podcast. We talked about Baylor winning a basketball title. I still can't get over that. Unbelievable. The men's. Here's hats off to you, fellas. Great job. We talked about the Cowboys in the draft, and we've talked about the Rangers, and that we kind of went out on a downer there. But
we talked about the barbecue, and we talked about my hamburger.
We did talk about the barbecue and your hamburger, which is the second food that some stupid restaurant in this town has dedicated to you. I can't believe it.
Biggest trend in Dallas food. Listen up, restaurateurs. You want to have a hot item, you want to name it after.
Yeah.
Me.
Exactly. All right. Well, that's going to do it for me in here and Evan and everybody. So from everybody in here to everybody out there, thanks. And we'll catch you next time.